I remember myself and Dad got in the car and I hadn't spoken all day, you know. And we got in the car and he drove me down to this beach called Guinness's Beach that we used to windsurf on. And we sat there for 3 hours in silence. And with a grovelly voice, after about 3 hours, I just said, it's just so unfair. And it was that admission out loud that this is really, really shit. And it's really testing me, and it's testing everyone. And from those places, you make decisions.
Jack Kavanagh is a man in his early 30s whose life in one catastrophic moment was transformed utterly when he dived into shallow water and broke his neck on a sandbank, leaving him paralysed from the shoulders down. That was 12 years ago. Now Jack Kavanagh is known not so much for his disability as his ability to do and achieve things, to advocate, to motivate and to believe in his own future. Jack, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I might challenge you on one word that you used in that intro, and that's the word catastrophic, because, you know, initially my consultant would have described the injury as a catastrophic injury, which it is. You know, a spinal cord injury will affect almost every body system. You know, what's seen on the outside is the paralysis, but really it has knock-on implications for the way that you manage all of your other body systems. But as time has gone on, I do wonder, was it such a catastrophe after all? Or was it the thing that ultimately pushed my life in a very different direction? Yes, but it's been the seed of a lot of good things as well, you know.
Do you think that you are maybe happier now than you might otherwise be as a 32-year-old man if this hadn't happened?
I don't know about that, but I certainly know that the research will say that people return reasonably quickly to a preset of their baseline sort of level of satisfaction with life within about 2 years of an injury like I sustained. Mm-hmm. So they'll go back to their previous preset value. Now, that's on average. We do know that for a lot of people, you know, they have post-traumatic stress, and you could call what happened in my life like a trauma of sorts, and there's layers to that. But people have post-traumatic stress and decline after an event like that. But what's less talked about is the idea of post-traumatic growth. And what you see is in about a third of people that experience trauma of any type, whether it's based on choices they make thereafter or the environments that they're exposed to, or it becomes a light bulb moment that the way I was living maybe wasn't the most in alignment with who I am or whatever it might be. It becomes, as we used the word a minute ago, just a seed for something new and an impetus for growth. And so I do think that based on any number of factors that have happened in the years since I had my injury, it has become more of a seed for growth for me. And in one way, I probably haven't sat still for too long.
Yeah, just to develop that if you would, Jack, because I'm wondering how much of it, and you did use the word choice there a few moments ago, how much of it is a decision that, you know, okay, stuff has happened, pretty awful things, my expectations have had to change completely, but I now have to decide what happens next.
Yeah. Okay, so there is, in my story, there is definitely not one choice, but a whole cascade of choices. And I talk about this idea, you know, of, you know, you get a choice whether you say yes or no, I can or I can't, to fight on or to give up. And they're not choices you make once. You choose to say, yes, I can, I will try again, I'll fight on. You make those choices in small moments repeatedly. But there's probably a bigger moment defining moment in my story. And it starts with my parents on the flight over to come and find me after I had the injury. I had an accident in Portugal, as you said, diving into water. And and I was air ambulanced away from my friends. They didn't know where I was being brought. And so the search commenced by ringing around the various hospitals in Lisbon and elsewhere. And my parents were on a flight over, and my mum asked Dad a question, which is very understandable. And she said, "Why Jack? Why would this happen to Jack?" And I went down that same line of questioning in the months after I had my injury. You know, I spent 28 days in intensive care, 28 days in high dependency, 49 days fully ventilator dependent, about 196 days thereafter in rehab. And so during that time, which amounted to nearly 9 months, there was periods where I certainly asked, why me? And it's a really important starting point, because it gives you the opportunity to face the tough realities. Like, I had always been a fit, active, engaged young person that loved expressing myself in the outdoors. And here I was with like 15% muscle function. And so that becomes an important starting point, because you face the tough realities and feel the tough emotions. And it's a grief cycle, which is really understandable, because you're grieving the imagined future that now is changed, and the way in which you knew of navigating the world. And that's a really important thing to do, because unless you acknowledge it and grieve it and engage with those tough things, you don't process them. You otherwise push them down. And part of that grief cycle is hitting the dip, or a natural depression. And that's to be expected, you know, after any kind of loss in our life. But at a certain point during that dip, and you don't know when you hit the bottom, I think is as you're hitting the bottom that you realise there's a choice moment here.
Yeah, we were chatting upstairs earlier about the fact that you've had the benefit of a Jesuit education at level. You went to Clongowes, a famous boarding school, and I suppose a place of privilege. And I think you've acknowledged that as well. But I was interested to come across a book a few years ago by a Jesuit, an Australian man, Richard Leonard, SJ, who wrote a book called Where the Hell is God? And he wrote it in response to an event in his own family's life, that his sister became quadriplegic as a result of an accident, a road accident. And she was somebody who was helping others. She was a nurse, and she was very valuable to people in deprived circumstances. I mean, is that a question that you would have asked yourself, Jack? Where the hell is God?
Yeah, well, look, that is the why me question in a way, isn't it? You know, you go soul searching and despairing and all of those pieces, and you're left saying, you know, is there something bigger than me here? And there's this, I don't know the exact saying, but there's this great image that I came across where there's two footprints in the sand on a beach, and then it turns to one footprint. And the analogy is that, you know, that phase when it was the single set of footprints, God deserted me, or the greater power than us deserted me, you know, and I was left walking on my own. And the response is from God, or whatever you believe in, it's like, no, that was when I was carrying you, you know. And in the moments when we most despair, maybe that's the time that we find strength that we didn't know we had. And I would often say, you know, it's easy to look back on periods of our life and say that's a time that I showed tenacity or fortitude or resilience or whatever way you want, or strength, whatever way you want to describe it. But often those periods in your life, you are confused and you're just trying to take the next step. And it's a day or an hour or a minute at a time. And you're just trying to get through and make some sense of what you're experiencing. And yet it's like with the benefit of hindsight that you can look back and say, wow, that was a period when I really dug deep. And it feels so different. It feels vulnerable and messy and confusing at the time. And I think those times when we're in it it's like, have I been deserted by God, is so to speak, if that's what you believe in. And I would say that I'm more spiritually inclined than I would be religiously inclined. But I think the way that I would read, like, I grew up with a Catholic upbringing, And I certainly would read those stories that are told in the Bible and so on as guideposts and value sets as to how to live our lives. And in so many of the stories, they are about decisions about, you know, how we treat the people around us and how do we look after and look out for others and the way that we seek hope and take inspiration from others, you know. And very often that's depicted as this archetype of Jesus or the apostles or whatever it is, and the various saints that are painted as the archetypes of the people that we look up to, and we all fall short of that at times, and maybe there are the periods when we despair and so on. But I also think looking back, there are the times when you can say, I was at my strongest, although I didn't know it at that time. I found resolve.
Because, but was it something that you felt, you know, you drew on religious or spiritual beliefs? Because, I mean, some people say, look, this would be enough now to turn me into an atheist. I mean, remember the famous Stephen Fry rant with Gay Byrne about how could there be a God when you look at all the awful things that happen to people?
And horrendous things happen. And you look at something like this morning, I heard statistics around the number of children that are diagnosed with cancers in Ireland every year. And you think about that on an international scale, and you would despair, you know, and say, well, if there is a God, you know, like, or if there's a higher power or whatever. And it is what makes you grapple with those things, I think, is when you're confronted with the tough realities that exist in different parts of life and the downright challenging and shit things that happen sometimes, you know, the curveballs that we least expect. And then there is the other side, you know, there's the hopeful history of humanity, which is that since we were cavemen and women, probably the thing that differentiated us from another species is that we developed the capacity to collaborate and to innovate and to problem solve and to seek progress. And listening to the news, we get the highlight reel of all the things that are going wrong or that need work on. But there's the 99% of people going about their days that are cooperating and problem solving in big ways and small ways and collaborating to move the needle forward. And that's out there as well. And so if you're going to acknowledge one side, let's be fair and acknowledge the other side. And it doesn't mean that you're not left wondering about all the harshness that does exist, but look at all the people that are working on solving those problems as well and are there to support during those times.
You were studying pharmacy. You were at the end of your first year in pharmacy in Trinity College when this accident happened. And pharmacy, I think, is notoriously or famously one of the most difficult courses to get into. Now, you had everything going for you. What were your expectations, Jack, of what life was going to bring you when you were that young man of 20?
Well, I was really big into water sports at the time. I played a lot of rugby growing up, and I did a lot of running, but water sports really took hold of me, particularly surfing and windsurfing, and I just loved the balance of like running, and in the rugged west of Ireland, I used to work down in Belmullet for the summers, and I loved the kind of wildness of the waves and the wind and just being out there. And my 5-year plan at that time was, I'm going to graduate, I'm going to work 4 days a week, and I'm going to have a van that I will kit out with my surfing and windsurfing gear, and I'll be spending Friday through Sunday camping on a beach somewhere and getting out on the water. Fast forward a number of years, I got the van, but just in a slightly different way. But genuinely, like, my 5-year plan was I was going to be traversing the beaches of Ireland over the weekends, and I had aspirations to travel different parts of the world. Sort of, it sounds a bit cringy to say it now, but back then I would have been like chasing the perfect wave, sort of a thing. And that adventurous spirit probably hasn't died at all. It's just been transformed a little bit into other pursuits.
You've spoken before about how in rehab you had this encounter with, I think it was a consultant who kind of was laying it on the line. Look, this is the life that you are facing. you reared up against that, didn't you?
Yeah, you could say that. I think it's okay in podcast format maybe to talk about this as it happened, but I was, you know, you have the sit down meeting because I had my injury in Portugal, and so we had the language barrier, where maybe they didn't have as honest chats with me as they might otherwise if I was in Ireland. And I got to rehab and they're sort of laying out for me, look, the diagnosis you have is C5 complete spinal cord injury, quadriplegic, 15% muscle function. Like, you're going to need the assistance of two people to do most things for the rest of your life. And this and this is off the cards. You will never X, Y, and Z. And I just turned around and I just said, well, fuck that. Like, that's not the expectations that I have for the life that I'm going to lead. And I was very fortunate in lots of ways through my rehab journey. And the reason that I consider myself fortunate is that I had a year of a health science under my belt. At that point, I had a certain level of health literacy that many of my peers in rehab didn't have. I could ask questions and challenge because of that and do my research. And that stood to me no end over time.
But here was an expert saying to you, Jack, two people all the time to do pretty much anything. I mean, on what basis could you fault that? I mean, was it just something in your gut or just something that's like, I can't accept that?
And there was maybe not necessarily that I can't accept that, because I wasn't in denial of my circumstance, but I also think there was no account of maybe the ingenuity that this might bring out of me. Or I looked around. I think role models are really important, you know, in different parts of our lives and different stages. And during that period, I had gone online and, you know, sought out role models who had been through testing circumstances in their own lives from around the world. And I'd reach out and I would take the outliers in all sorts of areas. And someone has to be the outlier. And they're the people that ultimately move things forward for the rest of the population, you know, whether it's the spinal injured population or those that befall any circumstance, you know. There are outliers and they show a way forward. And, you know, maybe people's expectations of what my aspiration was at that time would be to get just back walking. But there's so many other things that come with a spinal injury, and I was deluded to the minor percentage chance that I would have of walking of my own accord again. But there were so many other things that I wanted to engage in life that I was being told were off the table for me, that I refused to really let go of.
So what things have you been able to do that you were told, forget about that?
Well, you know, it was things from driving independently to travelling internationally. It was, you know, having a productive working life as a professional. It was the return to college and take on the demands of a pharmacy degree. It was to come out the other side of that and be engaged in life, you know, in a professional and a personal context. It was getting back into the outdoor environments that I love, whether it was on the water, sailing or kayaking, or on the greenways, biking, or up in the mountains, skiing.
Or skydiving.
Or, yeah, doing silly things like skydiving. My mum prefers to hear about things like that after the fact. So, you know, all of those things, the greatest thing that gets in the way is, I suppose, the narrative that you tell. And stories are sticky.
Well, what do you mean by that, stories are sticky?
Stories are sticky. Like, this is what someone with your circumstances is capable of. This is what someone from your background is capable of doing. These are the kind of jobs or the place in society that you can expect to get to with your demographic background or the place you grew up in. This is what someone in a family like us, you know, they're sticky stories. They're belief systems that get ingrained in us. And the belief systems and the stories that you buy into have a massive impact on the actions that you do or don't take, or the things that you entertain as possible or not possible in your life. And I just went systematically about resetting those belief systems and challenging them bit by bit. Because the part of the story that I didn't finish telling you earlier is, you know, my dad's response to my mum on the plane that day was to say, well, why not, Jack? Why should this have happened to anyone else on the beach? And like, I learned about that a few years later, and I first said to him, well, cheers, Dad, you know. But I had arrived at my own version of that as well, you know. You go through the grief cycle post-injury, which is a natural response, but you could get stuck there. And you could continue asking, why me, and become a victim of the scenario. Or you could entertain the alternative, which is often just as valid a case of why not me. And if you entertain that as a question, and you apply that across the different parts of your life, well, why not? And that opens up a whole different stream of thinking and of other questions and other possibilities. And the more you pursue that as a question or a framework for your life, well, certainly I've found myself in places I didn't expect.
Such as? What kind of places?
You know, that... As a question, you know, well, why not, leads you to having interactions you otherwise never have. One door opens, another opens, another opens, another, you know, and it's the butterfly effect. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings in one part of the world and there's a hurricane somewhere else, you know. You can't see the kind of momentum. It's hard to account for the momentum building nature of, you know, if you continue asking that question in its various guises, how that pans out over time.
Was it a process for your parents and your sisters as well of grieving, and that they had to come through this, maybe not as intensely as you, but nonetheless, I mean, it must have been an extraordinarily difficult time for them.
Equally as intensely as me, in their own ways. Something that is very often lost in a scenario like this is the impact on the people that surround you. Everyone asks, how's Jack? Very seldom did people ask, how are Claire and Jean, my two younger sisters, dealing with this? You know, their lives were massively transformed as a result of this. At pivotal periods in their lives as well, you know, Claire had moved out into first year college the week that I, like the day before that I had my injury. Jean was going into an exam year in school. Parents are trying to keep a business afloat and like manage their emotional response to this thing that has happened, yet be there for their children. And where do they take care of themselves within all of that? You know, there's impacts on everyone. There is an extent to which your private life is now not so private anymore, in that people are incredible and come out of the woodwork at times to help, but it feels like intrusive, and you've never had to ask for help in that way before or be on the receiving end of it. And yet it's exactly what you would hope you would do if it happened to someone close to you. And so there's all these layers that are going on, and they talk about, you know, the second victim syndrome, which is often, you know, the people surrounding the individual that is immediately affected, you know.
What were you like to live with in those early stages, Jack? I mean, dealing with Claire and Jean and your mother and father. I mean, like, were there outbursts and just moments of just anger?
Yeah. You know, like, I've mentioned it a few times now, but like, alongside the grief cycle comes a variety of stages, you know, and you would love if it happened stepwise and I could tell you month by month which stage I'd be in, but it's messy, you know, and so you have the anger and the shock and denial, and then the anger and bargaining, you know, and then you have the depression, and eventually you come to a place of reconstruction and imagining a new life. But as I went through, I would say that the denial and the anger and bargaining sections, like, there was days and weeks where I struggled to make eye contact and really engage with anything. I didn't want people to see the pain that I was in. Yes, like, had physical pain, but like mentally and emotionally, I just didn't want my family to have to take it on. And yet by me disengaging and being silent and not making eye contact, you know, they were the victims of that anyway. And there was times when, you know, all of my healthy stress management systems of going out for a run or getting on the water or playing rugby with a group of mates or heading out the fields or onto the beach with a dog, all of those healthy ways I had of managing the stresses that we all experience had been removed from me at the most stressful period I'd ever experienced. And so I remember one day back at home, I'd left rehab and I was back at home and all of my friends were away on their J1s and I had moved back out to the countryside and felt completely isolated and I couldn't drive. I could barely do anything for myself, feed myself and brush my teeth. That was about it. And my mum was cleaning out a press in the kitchen. We have this kind of half island, I think it's called a peninsula in the kitchen world. And she had some crockery up on and glasses up on the on this island. And I turned around from sitting at the kitchen table and I was in an awful way. And I just saw this as my opportunity for a release. And I cleaned off all the glasses onto the floor and just left the room. And I had like this brief moment of relief. I feel better for having like just expressed this in some way, within the immediate guilt that mum is going to clean that up now because I have just absconded responsibility and left. So there was like the many layers of that. But over time,
Was that a one-off thing?
Yeah, like I have to say, I think I went inward more than taking it out on the people around me. But like there was very tough times. Mm. Like we went on a trip down the west of Ireland. We used to holiday in, we love Connemara and we used to go down there with like our bodyboards and, you know, these kind of things when we were kids. And we went on a trip down there for a week the summer I got out. And like this place that represented so much freedom to me was now on wheels, the most isolating, restrictive place that I could go. Now, over the years, each year I've gone back with, you know, different pieces of equipment that restore my freedom out there. But that first summer, I just felt so restricted. And I was going through the dip at that stage, you know, and it was, I turned 21 and I remember writing a poem when I was down there and it talked about like the salt stinging my cheeks from my tears and stuff like this. And you mentioned expectations earlier, like the expectations of where I would be at 21 versus where I was. It was just poles apart, you know, mm-hmm. And my life was on a very different track to where a lot of my peers were at that time. And I remember myself and Dad got in the car and I hadn't spoken all day, you know, and we got in the car and he drove me down to this beach called Guinness's Beach that we used to windsurf on. And we sat there for 3 hours in silence. And with a grovelly voice, after about 3 hours, I just said, it's just so unfair. And it was that admission out loud that this is really, really shit. And it's really testing me and it's testing everyone. And it, like I said, from those places you make decisions. And although we might not have called it the why not me at that time, there was small decisions being made while you go through those periods that over time play out to be big things. And like one of the things I think that was instrumental for me was going through rehab as a family. We came together and we made the decision that, you know, I need something that was going to motivate me. And that was to get back to college for the next academic year. And like Now I would describe that as having something that was inspiring in the future. And the word inspire medically means to breathe in. And it's almost like the thing that gives you the oxygen to keep going on the tough days.
If I was sitting in the side of the car that your dad was sitting in that day you went to the beach, I haven't a clue what I would have said to you in response. Did he say anything to you?
I don't recall, but there wasn't really a need. Like, there was just a need for the release of admitting it.
Yeah. And your mum, when the crockery and the glasses went flying from the peninsula.
You can just imagine it.
One of two things could have happened, at least.
Yeah.
How did she, did she take the head off you, so to speak?
But like, there's also a total understanding of, like, how do you express it?
Yeah.
And here's the thing is, like, if you don't find ways of expressing that type of, like, and it shows up for all of us at times, like, we have the parts of ourselves that we love to put on show publicly, but every single one of us have the shadow traits as well, and the things that we like to keep behind closed doors.
That's actually something I wanted to ask you about, Jack, that, you know, you go and you give these talks to whether they're companies or school students, whatever. And, you know, essentially you have to kind of put on a performance and you have to give them a reason for wanting to make the most of the circumstance in which they find themselves. But here we are now, like 12 years on. I mean, do you have down days?
No matter what you do in life, no matter what role you take on in life, whether it's as a parent or as a presenter or, you know, or as a doctor or a nurse or a programmer, whatever it is, like, in those roles, there's an expectation that you place on yourself or someone else place on you of a level of performance. And so there's parts of our lives where we're all striving towards a performance. Mm. And so I don't think there's necessarily something disingenuous in that. I do think that that's the thing that activates our reward circuitry and brings the best out of us. But there's parts of our lives where we just don't need to be on all the time.
Yeah.
And I do have bad days.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much bad days as I have, like, periods and parts of my day and my week where I by nature of some of what I do, I need to be extroverted in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And there's periods and times where I need to recuperate that energy and I'm introverted in nature. And, you know, that's the prep work and it's the behind the scenes and it's the things that I do myself or with the team. And then there's the parts that are public facing where you're on, you know, and they're different skill sets. And then there's times when things just go wrong and you're left having to grapple with those horrible, uncomfortable thoughts and feelings and expressing the feelings, because, like, in a healthy way. And for me, my primary ways of doing that are through threefold. I would say fourfold. One is I read a lot of Buddhism and Stoicism in the early days after my injury. And that led me into, particularly the Buddhism, led me into breathing practices and meditation. So that's one of my areas that I'll turn to. Now that I have got the equipment I need and the use of myself, I suppose, that I can, I use exercise and training as a big way to regulate myself. But also, I'm very fortunate that I have really good friends and that, you know, we all need people that we can process our lives with. And so they're three of the things. But the fourth one would be to find meaning on the days that are really tough and challenging and say, like, this is tough and I can't get around, like, that this feels challenging or unjust. I'll give you an example in a second. And yet if you can strive in those moments to say, well, is this here to teach me something, or is there something that I can learn from this, or is there fuel within this to push me forward, or whatever it is. I was in Brussels yesterday. I flew in on Tuesday and out last night on Wednesday night, and I flew in Tuesday morning. I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to be at the airport, and we got to landed in Brussels at 9:30, and I was due to be where I needed to be within the hour. and I'd booked a wheelchair accessible taxi. And when we got there, the taxi wasn't accessible. We spent an hour and a half between different agencies trying to get an accessible taxi in like what is the European capital of Parliament and all these kinds of things. That seems like a, felt like a massive injustice. Like, how are we not further on in 2024 in terms of, you know, access to these things that we consider basic in certain parts of the world and Europe? Then on the way back to the airport the following day, having found a company that would provide an accessible taxi, they, same story, booked an accessible taxi, one that was inaccessible, arrived, called them, oh, we don't do that anymore. Well, you were doing it yesterday, you know, and this cycle repeated. And
so what was your temperament then? How did you react to that? To those,
I go silent, and internally the narrative is like there was, I would say, complete demoralization on one level. I would say anger on another level, like it, not that it felt like a personal affront, but it's like I have the capacity to speak up and manage a scenario like that. But for all of those that don't have that, or that, you know, don't have maybe some of the communication skill sets that I have to navigate that scenario or to get out and advocate on the back of something like that. Like yesterday, I needed to process that. Today, that's my fuel for progressing things, you know, and I think there's any number of ways that you can experience that. Like I was delivering a keynote at a big conference in Dublin back in January, Pendulum Summit, and that was, would be considered a reasonably big stage in Ireland, in the convention centre in Dublin, and I had put in significant amount of prep for it, and I got up that day, got myself sorted, drove in to be in there early. I was on after lunch. I was to be in around 10 o'clock. I landed on the quays, and as soon as I landed and parked on the quays, I realised, shite, today is the one in a million that I'm after having medical mishap, and I had to up sticks straight back home, like sort myself out. Complications of a spinal injury happened to kick in that day, sort myself out. And they're the moments where you're like, right, I'm being tested now. Mm. I'm being tested on what I'm about to speak about later. And so if I was nervous for the session I was to deliver in front of whatever 1500 people that afternoon, actually the nerves were gone by the time I dealt with that initial test.
You did make it back, did you?
I made it back in, yeah. And so there's an interesting piece that I've been learning about the challenge mindset. And if in response to, you know, stressful things that happen, we have the belief system that stress is debilitating, it becomes that. Whereas if we, and like you suffer the negative health implications of stress if you have that belief system. This is, we talked about belief systems and stories are sticky earlier. And this is one of the ways it plays out. Like if I have a belief system that like stress and the release of cortisol and adrenaline is bad for my health and X, Y, and Z, and it overwhelms me and it leads me to anxiety or whatever it is, that's the story that becomes true. And that's your physiological experience as well, measurably. But if your belief system is stress is enhancing, which they call the challenge mindset, you know, something that takes me outside my comfort zone happens is the essence of what a stressor is. You know, a stressor is applied. And if your belief system is stress is enhancing, you tap into enhanced functioning and you make better use of your internal and external resources. So, and like you can apply that in any.
And how did the
ways.
Talk go in the end?
Yeah, I it was very well received.
Out of the park.
So I think this like dynamic plays out in lots of ways, yeah. And it's coming up again and again in our chat, you know.
Yeah, what about the aviation one? Because I saw a piece in The Currency recently that you had a group of aviation leaders and you were making your case for just improving the, if you like, the user experience for people like yourself flying.
Okay, well, here's the other example of how it comes up. So how did I end up in that room? Speaking about that topic, well, I've been an avid traveller over the last number of years and have had repeated poor experiences travelling as a wheelchair user. And at a certain point, with anything, you let it slip, you let it slip, you let it slip, and at a certain point you reach your saturation point where enough becomes enough. And that happened during the autumn in my case, and around that time a number of others just happened to get in touch with me and say, I've had this poor experience and I've had this experience and this is what happened in my case and that's what happened. And I went online and I started realising, oh my, there is people all over the world having this experience. Some of them are sharing it in different fora. And so I brought it to Declan Ryan, formerly of Ryanair, and I said, you know, this is my experience and this is what I've learned about others. And he said, right, we need to do something about this. And he was telling me there was an aviation conference coming up and he said, we were hosting a breakfast. Would you like to say a few words at it? And had I known who was in the room that day, I might have been nervous. But that I did my prep and I started with the human story, which was my story and some of those that I'd uncovered from others' personal experiences. And then I went to the stats and told the story from an evidence base. And then I proposed some of the solutions. And like some of the statistics that I were pulling were from the States, where on average, every single day, 32 pieces of mobility equipment, which are essential for the traveler, are either misplaced in that, like I get on a flight, say in one location, and I arrive in the other location, but the essential piece of equipment that I need to be independent doesn't arrive.
Like your wheelchair?
Like my wheelchair. Or it's damaged to an extent that it's unusable. So that's happening 32 times a day just in the States. But when you extrapolate that over time, I think it was in the period from the beginning of January 2019 to May 22, when that report that I read was published, 36,000 wheelchairs or pieces of mobility equipment had either been misplaced or permanently damaged. And like, so we spelled out, okay, there comes a cost but compensating for that. But let's talk about the human cost and the economic cost and the knock on. And if I was to tell you that for like every journey that someone with reduced mobility takes, or for every 100 journeys that someone takes, 1.5 of those will have that experience of, you know, misplaced or permanently damaged. And we started saying, like, would it be acceptable if 200 people got on a flight and on the far end of that flight, three of them had their legs broken? Because that's the equivalent of what's happening.
So what did you suggest they needed to do?
So we laid it out because there was like maybe an understandable ignorance, you know, of these are some of the experiences. And that was one part of it. There's the other sort of humiliating or dehumanizing parts that go with traveling and being lifted on and off a plane and different things like that. And so we looked at the realities of many experiencers as a user experience and a customer journey, sort of to use that language. And we explored the potential solutions and prototypes that are being explored in different parts of the world for seating arrangements where, for example, like on any other form of transport, be it a bus or a train or the Lewis or a taxi now, that you can travel end to end using a wheelchair without ever getting in or out. And there's a business case for that, by the way. There's a massive business case for like 15% of the world's population at any time have some form of disability. And there's a percentage of those that have like a mobility requirement. And all of those people have money to spend, and you bring that individual travels and they travel with a family or they travel with friends and they they want to have the same business and pleasure experiences of everyone else. And so you start telling that story and all of a sudden airlines are like, oh, there might be something to this. You know, if there's a few quid to be made, it's not just the right thing to do, but there's a business case.
As a matter of interest, you talk about people in that room at that breakfast. Have you had any direct engagement with another old Clongonian, Michael O'Leary of Ryanair?
I haven't tailored my ask to him just yet, but you can put him on notice that it'll be coming. I know, like, honestly, what's become clear is that there's the carrot and the stick approach. And the carrot approach is, this is a nice thing to do and it's the socially responsible thing to do. But that doesn't always convince a significant business, you know. So if you can push it from the regulatory side, that is the place to go, and you make it a standard that all airlines have to meet, then it doesn't become a competition piece. It becomes just a necessity.
You're still a very young man, Jack. You're in your early 30s. You have experienced an awful lot. I'm wondering what you want to do with the rest of your life.
It's a good question. You know, I've been fortunate over the last number of years that I've taken my health professional training and I've been able to apply that in different ways. I worked in a number of healthcare settings and maybe more recently have been involved with some work with the World Health Organization, and that's been interesting to me. I would always say I have a before and an after story in that I've seen the world at 6'1" and 4 foot something of on my feet and on four wheels. And so that perspective has opened my eyes maybe to the challenges of a certain portion of society. And without ever intending to, I found myself learning more and grappling with and trying to move things forward for that population.
Yeah, I mean, even though it's probably an option, I couldn't actually see you being fully satisfied with, you know, spending a large part of the rest of your life running a pharmacy in Dunshaughlin, worthy and all as that might be. And it might have been part of one of your 5-year plans. What about something like politics?
You know, I think there are times in your life where you kind of get called forward. I don't know how many people that are currently in politics that had it as a plan since they were young, but something arrived in their life where there was an impetus to seek change. And they said, you know, if I don't go after this and push for this, maybe it won't happen. Or maybe I'm tired of sitting on the sidelines and I want to get into the arena. I would say that I've found myself in the arena over the last number of years in different ways. And there's an argument to say that, like, anything that we do to seek to make change is political on some level.
Yeah, I mean, lobbying is one form of political activity, and clearly you're able to do that with the kind of talks that you've just been describing, and also you're on the board, I think, of the National Disability Authority. But, you know, in terms of the platform and access to the levers of power, politics does have its appeal, doesn't it?
Yeah, quite likely. You're the one that's planting the seed here, Sean. So what are you seeing?
Well, I put it like this. I've been a member of the Oireachtas Press Gallery for all of 44 years, which goes back 12 years before you were born. And to me, I could see you being in there, in that arena, in the Dáil, in the Seanad, in the European Parliament, whatever. And certainly in terms of a face on a poster, I think you could do well.
Well, what's that saying? You've a great face for the radio. That's funny.
I mean, you have communication skills, you have life experience, which goes way beyond your years, and you have things that you want to achieve. I mean, why wouldn't you throw your hat into the political ring?
Noted.
You heard it first on the Insides podcast. Well, look, Jack, just a couple of other things, because about the future, and maybe it's not a 5-year plan, maybe it's something that, you know, you live in hope for. You've talked before about things like assisted technologies. Now, I've seen, again, on one of the documentary that was done, that's a lot of years ago now, on TV3, a superb account of your a trip you made, a road trip in California, and you found yourself in San Francisco, I think it was, with a company. You were actually taking steps.
Yeah, so they call it, it's the exobionics exoskeleton. And what it facilitates people to do is people with neurological conditions, whether it's a spinal injury or a stroke or any number of other conditions, it allows them to go in a supported way from sitting to standing and to take steps. So like if I was to arrive up today and I'd never used it before, they'll measure my limb length of my femur and my different parts of my body, and they adjust the suit to fit. And I get into the suit and it attaches at different points on my legs and my hips and around my core. And you go from sitting to standing and you become an Iron Man for a short period of time, or woman. And I first trialed that suit in the UK, and then, as you said, over in the headquarters of Exobionics in the US. And that suit was initially developed, that technology was initially developed by Exobionics for the US military. And it was to help soldiers to carry heavy loads on foot without doing damage to their joints. And they said, you know what, there's actually a rehabilitative application to this, and maybe we can make it translate to sort of more a rehab and a medical model. And that's what they've done. And now there's a number of companies that are in that arena. And so every week now I go walking in DCU. They have two adult exoskeletons available and one pediatric suit available. And it's one example of an assistive device. And, you know, it's a no-brainer that these are funded. Every week, about between 50 and 80 adults walk in the suit, and the pediatric program has just begun this February, which is really exciting, you know. And the reason I say it's exciting is because, you know, all of us are meant to be upright and walking. Our bodily systems are designed for that. So yes, there's the psychological and emotional thrill that comes with getting up initially, but that begins to wear off, and the reason you keep going is for the physiological or the bodily benefits that you get. So my bone density has improved. Every time I get up, the opportunity to stretch out my limbs, I'm upright, all of my blood flow and lymphatic drainage and all those kind of things that we take for granted are improved. You know, for the first 5 years or so post-injury, I didn't have regular access to something like this. Whereas every day at home, I stand in a standing frame in the mornings for a couple of minutes just to get up and stretch out. But once a week, I go walking. And the additional benefits of that, of taking 1,000 steps on a Monday or a Friday afternoon in my case, what that adds to me is huge, because I'm not just doing it for the benefits for Jack today. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it for Jack in 5 years and 10 years and 30 years. Deconditioning happens very quickly in the body if you're not active in using it. And so that forms part of a training regime. But what's cool is in the people that take on the likes of the exoskeleton as a training modality is that they adopt other health-seeking behaviors outside of their hour walking a week, so that they can continue to put themselves in a position to do the walking. And so that's really exciting. But assistive technology comes in all ways, shapes and forms. So you're wearing glasses today. That's a type of assistive technology. I'm using a wheelchair is another type of assistive technology. Like previously, I would have looked on and said, God, a wheelchair is a confining sort of a thing. Actually, it's the most liberating thing you could have access to if you need it.
It's all about the mindset, isn't it?
Yeah. And so we live in a Western country, and like many of the Western countries, we've got aging populations. We've got people that are having to work for longer because pension pots are getting squeezed and these kinds of things. And so recently I was on a trip, a collaboration between the Irish government and the World Health Organization over to Oslo to learn about the way that the Norwegians roll out the digital and assistive technologies. And they're rolling these technologies out from everyone, from a young kid that has a mobility device requirement to a student with a neurodiversity that's transitioning from college to employment, to an elderly person that has dementia and wants to age in place in their home. And these are all people that can benefit from assistive technologies across the lifespan. And so I think the cool thing about the Norwegian model is that they look at the citizen and how do we empower and enable the citizen to continue to remain engaged into society and to continue contributing. And so looking at the ways that we roll out digital and assistive technologies to empower and help our population to continue engaging and contributing in society, I think it's a no-brainer.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the team. Tell me more.
My team would be a variety of people. I would consider like family and close friends a part of my team. But I also have a number of people that work with me as personal assistants. And what I mean by that is, as a paradigm, people previously would have thought about care assistants. Personal assistants is about agency, about autonomy for someone that might have a disability or additional requirements. So I need assistance in the morning and in the evening, in my case, with some personal care issues, but also they empower me to be much more independent through my day. And
literally
and
to get
out
and get into bed.
Literally, yeah. Mm. As independent as I am through the day, you know, I drove here today for to record this episode, and I'll be independent through the day. There are places and times in my life where I do need that support, and it's hugely empowering for me. But also, you know, as part of running a business, there's, you know, there's accounts, there's agents, there's different things like that that I would consider as part of the team.
You've got things very well organised, and you've got a lot of support and a lot of friends and a structure that's there. Are you in pain?
Yeah. Now, it varies day to day. I choose not to take pain medication, largely speaking. I find that it, most of the time, makes me maybe drowsy or has other effects at times that I would prefer to avoid. And so for me, I manage it a lot through lifestyle approaches. So with a spinal injury often comes neuropathic pain. The ways for me to manage that are things that anybody can benefit from. Good quality sleep. You know, regular movement and exercise. When it does hit hard, breathing techniques are really beneficial for me. It's hard to do that in the moment unless you've been practicing when you're not under fire of pain, if that makes sense. So regularly I engage with breathing techniques. I find them really, really good if you've got a busy mind and you're trying to focus. So I'll do like breathing exercises, and then I'm like, I've got much better focus afterwards. But then that has a knockover effect that when I do particular breathing techniques, when I'm in pain, it's easier to do them because I'm in the rhythm of having a practice, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So they're some of the things that are helpful. Heat exposure is really good for me. So whether it's a hot shower, or if I can get access to a sauna or a heat pack, or just getting warm and staying warm. And so there are some of the kinds of things. Some of the surfaces, like clothing textures, can cause me real trouble in some parts of my body where I would get like really heightened sensitivity. But these are some of the things that, like, if we were spending a day together, I might be going through a period of pain, and the only time you might catch it is if you caught a sideways look at me and I was wincing or something on doing a certain movement. And so it's something that I live with. Some days are very much pain free. Others are a bit of a struggle in that way. But I have to say, when I am committed to the lifestyle pieces and I schedule them in, which I'm pretty good at doing, because I feel better in myself, it's a good stimulus to do it, then the pain isn't such a big consideration for me day to day. But, you know, when I'm pushing hard, when I'm tired, when I've early mornings and late nights, just like anyone, it does take a bit of a toll on you. And one of the ways that shows up for me is I get a heightened level of pain. And that's kind of my impetus to say, maybe I need to sense check myself here. I need to look at the demands that I have on myself or I'm placed on myself. Where can I pull back? What can I change? And I get a short, sharp a dose of pain to maybe keep me in check every now and then.
Look, Jack, it's been absolutely fascinating, and a privilege for me to just listen to those insights. Thank you so much indeed for coming to studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.